This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Welcome, everybody. This is a great day. We come to a bit of a punctuation mark in this series of talks. As those of you who've been with us before will know, what we've done over the last 12 months or so is introduce you to a number of the objects that will find their way into the Australian Humanities Gallery, either in its first at opening or subsequently. But what Martha Sear, who's the senior curator on Australian Journeys, is doing today is telling us about the journey and the story, which is great. So this will be, I think Martha talked about giving a sense of the themes and the final list of themes and objects that will make their way to the gallery, because that's pretty much locked down.
Yeah.
And then some of you will have seen we're planning a behind-the-scenes tour of the gallery in November, which is a work in progress. So this is a great opportunity to have
you.
So, welcome, Martha.
Off we go. Thank you, Judy. Thank you, everybody. Thank you for coming along today. And welcome to, as Judy said, a very momentous behind-the-scenes talk for Australian Journeys. So today I'll be presenting to you an overview of the new Australian Journeys Gallery. The gallery, as some of you will already have learned, explores Australia's connections to the world from ancient times to now. Australian Journeys is due to open on the mezzanine space above the Eternity and Old New Land galleries at the end of this year. And those of you who know the museum well will recall that the mezzanine space previously was the location of the Horizons Gallery. So if you can imagine that space, we've completely removed the showcases and contents of the old gallery, and everything is completely different. An entirely new gallery will fill that space now. But before I begin, can I acknowledge the large team of people that are working behind the scenes to bring this gallery to fruition? There are, at the moment, hundreds of people, both within the museum and beyond its walls, who are involved in making this gallery come to life. And with 3 months to go, everyone is working with maximum effort and dedication. And so I just want to thank all of those people, and there are a number of them in the room today, including the curators, Judy, people like Polly, media ops, everybody from Friends. It's a massive undertaking to produce a gallery like this, and it's hard to underestimate how many people are involved and how significant their contributions individually are. So I just want to thank all of those people, many of whom can't be here today, but who are busily working on building showcases and doing conservation treatments and packing objects whilst I'm here speaking. So I also want to thank all of you. I want to thank the Friends, because you've played a part in bringing the gallery to life as well. I guess, as Judy said, over the last sort of 12 to 18 months, we've been joining you roughly every month to bring you the latest research from the curatorial team developing the gallery. And you've come along to hear curators talk about the objects that you might see, the convict love tokens, the bamboo musical instrument, the Latvian national dress, or John Gore's telescope. And you might have been to those talks. And the questions, the feedback, the comments, the suggestions that you made during those presentations have helped shape the gallery as it's evolved. And so I also want to thank all of you for contributing to the creation of Australian Journeys. So where in previous talks we'd chosen to look at individual objects or collections, today I'd like to give you a view of the gallery as a whole by taking you on a walk through the exhibits from one end of the gallery to the other. And at the end of the presentation, I'd like to open the floor to all of you to ask any questions that you might have, either about the specific exhibits that we are featuring in the gallery, or perhaps about the way that museums put galleries like this together. It's obviously a huge logistical exercise, and so you may be curious about how it is that the exhibit that you see finally in the gallery, what happens to make that happen. And if you would like to ask any of those questions, please feel free to ask them at the end of my part of the presentation today. So to start with, let me give you a few a few of the facts about Australian Journeys that might just help you get your head a bit around what we're talking about here. As I've said, Australian Journeys is the first new exhibition in the permanent galleries of the National Museum since the museum opened. So it's the first of the galleries to be renewed, and it's part of an ongoing program of development at the museum, which is called the Museum Enhancement Program. Many of you will have seen the new Circa rotating theatre. It was the first cab off the rank in terms of the renewal program here at the museum, and Australian Journeys is the first of the permanent galleries to be renewed. So it's quite a milestone in the life of the museum to have begun the process of renewing the galleries that were installed 7 years ago now, and bringing fresh new approaches to our permanent gallery program. And the gallery that will follow Australian Journeys, Creating a Country, opens in the Nation Space in about 2 years' time. So there's a sort of staged program of trying to renew the galleries, and this is the first gallery off the rank. The gallery space is around 600 square metres, and it's been enlarged thanks to some major primary works over the last 2 months. I'm not sure if any of you have visited the museum in the last couple of months, but the galleries have been shrouded in black plastic, and there's been the not-so-distant sound of drilling as the gallery space was expanded. So the floor has changed shape. We had to introduce new formwork and actually pour new concrete to make the floors work. It was a very exciting day when the concrete was poured in through the roof of the museum into the gallery space. So it'll be a different gallery when you go up there, because the floor space will have changed. So we've increased the floor space. In the gallery, there are 42 separate exhibits, and they're housed in 34 individual showcases. And all those showcases are just being completed down in Melbourne, and they'll be shipped up to us in about 10 days' time. All up, there are, I think at last count, 744 objects in the Australian Journeys Gallery. That's about double the number that you would have seen in Horizons. So Horizons had about 350 objects. It's a large number of objects, and we're quite proud of the fact that the gallery will be very, very rich and full of fascinating items for you to look at. It's also, I think, a source of pleasure in the museum that a significant proportion of those objects will be drawn from the museum's own collection, the National Historical Collection. And we've undertaken, as you know, a considerable amount of research into the museum's collection to find those little jewels that will be the heart of the exhibits in Australian Journeys. We've also borrowed a large number of objects from private lenders and from other collecting institutions, both within Australia and internationally. So when you visit the gallery at the end of December, you'll find objects that we've borrowed from the British Museum, the American Museum of Natural History, the National Library of Ireland, and the Museum of Ethnography in Leiden, amongst other collections here and abroad that we'll be bringing to the museum for you to look at. And to give you a sense of the time span, this gallery has been in development for around 4 years. So the end of this year will be the culmination of a long period of work, particularly for the curatorial team and the project management team, and the conservators and the registrars who've been working pretty solidly for 3 to 4 years on the content. So what is the gallery about? We've talked in brief about what the gallery is about, but to give you a little more detail, Australian Journeys explores the passages of people to and from Australia and examines how these journeys connect Australia to the rest of the world. The gallery traces the ways in which migrants and travellers have made places in Australia and overseas, and how they've built and maintained connections between places here and places abroad. It also considers how these connections between places have shaped Australian life more broadly. So to give you a sense of the gallery's aims, it is to represent the migrations, sojourns and travels of people to and from Australia and the social, economic and political impacts of those journeys, and to reveal the transnational character of Australian experience through the connections of Australian places to places overseas. The gallery is broadly chronological in structure, beginning in the period before European settlement and concluding in the 21st century. It's comprised of a series of relatively autonomous exhibits. So when I say there are 38 exhibits, there are 38 separate, self-contained sets of objects that tell an individual story. Each exhibit invites visitors to engage with often very individual and personal stories of travel to or travel from Australia, and to explore how travellers have built and maintained connections between places in Australia and places overseas. Through those stories, visitors are invited to contemplate broader questions about how Australia has shaped and been shaped by global forces and conditions. So this is really the part of the museum where we open out to the world. We look at how the world has affected Australia's history and the experiences of people who've lived here, and equally how Australia and Australians, by their travels and movements around the world, have changed and shaped international history. So what I'm going to do now is walk you from one end of the gallery to the other, to walk you from the end of the gallery that deals with the past through to the present day. I'm going to do that with the help of some PowerPoint slides. But also, I've printed out some copies of the floor plan of the gallery, which might help you kind of visualise what I'm talking about as I go through. Based on our visitor surveys and feedback from the hosts, we know that most visitors enter the gallery from the Boab Tree end, the Cubbies end of the gallery. And when people walk up those stairs, which look very different, I'd really encourage you to take a stroll up into the gallery after this and see there's been quite a transformation up there. The visitors will get to the landing of the stairs, and they will see a replica of Martin Behaim's 1541 terrestrial globe, which is one of the earliest representations, physical representations of the idea of the Earth as a sphere. And of course, the creation of a globe forces people to confront that they don't know a lot about the bits at the bottom. So as they know a lot about the bits at the top, where Europe is and Asia is, but when they actually make a globe, they have to put something at the bottom, so they put stuff there that they think might be there. They put monsters and strange creatures and a pointer. Excellent. So they imagine what might be living in the south part of the world. And so we put the globe there so that people could begin the journey by thinking about how the place that we live in now was once an imaginary place. It was once somewhere that was the home of monsters and people with feet on their heads and all sorts of crazy Antipodean things. And then as visitors... I get to use the pointer. As they ascend the stairs and come up to this area, they'll find an exhibit that deals with the imagining of the Great Southland in the period prior to European voyaging to Australia. So there we will see a series of medieval maps that depict different versions of what might be living in the area of the globe to the south. It's full of some really beautiful, beautiful maps. So the opportunity to see those medieval maps is going to be quite remarkable, I think. As visitors get to this area, they'll find an orientation marker. There are three orientation markers in the gallery. One here. I love this thing. One there. And another one that is there but is not shown in the drawing. And they're like little jewel cases. It's where we introduce the gallery to the visitors. And the one at this end has a magnifier that was used by Captain James Cook. So it'll be just in a little beautiful case, and it'll just be the starting point for people to get a feel for what they're going to see. As they walk to here, they'll find an exhibit that deals with Indigenous journeys, the journeys of Indigenous people across the Australian continent over many, many thousands of years. And we've chosen to focus here on two particular journeys of Indigenous people. The first of the Torres Strait Islanders, whose journeys of trade with Papua New Guinea and with mainland Australia saw them create astonishing and beautiful headdresses and trade shell and cassowary feathers so that they could create these beautiful headdresses. But we'll also be exploring a trade route that connected Cape York in Queensland all the way through the Lake Eyre area into South Australia. So a very, very long trade route that connects the north of Australia to the south of Australia. So Indigenous Journeys Across the Continent is really the first exhibit that people will find after the Great Southland exhibit. After visitors reach the centre of that mezzanine space, if I go back, here they'll find a large case dedicated to European voyages to Australia. And there they'll find a large collection of material, about 35 to 40 objects, almost all from the museum's own collection, I'm happy to say, that explore the voyages of the Dutch, the Spanish, the French and the English to the Australian continent. So the first real landfall on Australia, in West Australia and on the East Coast as well. And that's where you'll find the French bust of Captain Cook, Captain Cook's plane table, so the surveying tool that he used to do a running survey of the coast of eastern Australia during his first Pacific voyage, his teacup, John Gore's telescope, so some of you may have heard Michelle's talk on the Gore telescope, so an achromatic lens telescope that Gore used on his voyages with Cook to the Pacific, and then material relating to the scientific aspects of Cook's voyaging and Joseph Banks' creation of the Florilegium. So the museum recently purchased a set of the Florilegium prints and they'll be on display as well. We'll also be showing material relating to Dutch shipwrecks on the western coast of Australia and some of the embroidered maps that were created by English schoolgirls to record the voyages of Cook and other British sailors during this period. So it's going to be quite a remarkable collection of material associated with European voyages to Australia. You will also be able to touch a piece of ballast that was thrown overboard from Endeavour when it struck the reef in Queensland in 1770, and that'll be in a separate little section where you can actually feel the surface of the ballast, which is quite special. After that, you will find a series of cases that deal with 18th and 19th century journeys to and from Australia. So this is the part of the gallery that I'm talking about. It's just here. Yep. So you will find cases that deal with the First Fleet and the experience of transported convicts. I'm not sure if any of you went to the Furniture History Conference last year, but we presented some research there relating to the First Fleet table, a table made from beefwood, Botany Bay beefwood, a kind of wood that was found in the Botany Bay Lane Cove area of Australia, and a particular piece of it was sent back to Britain by John White, who was the first, the surgeon of the First Fleet. And he sent a piece of the wood back to his patron in England, Sir Andrew Snape Hammond, and the wood was turned into this table. And it was recently acquired by the museum at an auction in Britain after more than 200 years in the Andrew Snape Hammond's family. So that exhibit will allow you to trace the journey of the piece of wood from the moment it was cut down through all of the tools that would have been required to make the table, from the first cutting of the wood through to the final veneering on the top. So that should be, it'd be really fascinating to see how the table was actually made. We also have John White's own copy, his own personal copy of the journal that he published during his time in New South Wales, and that'll be on display as well. So that's going to be quite a precious object to finally have out on the floor. We'll also be in this area exploring exhibits relating to the Irish convict and political prisoner William Smith O'Brien. And if you went to the Staffordshire figurine talk, then we've developed an exhibit around the figurines of O'Brien, who was convicted of high treason in the late 1840s for his leading a rebellion against British rule in Ireland. He was a British parliamentarian, and he was sent to Tasmania. And we have been able to borrow the journal that he kept whilst he was here and an address that was given to him when he left. So they're very prestigious loans that we've been able to get from the National Library in Ireland. In the centre of this space, there's a case that deals with how the gold rushes enmeshed Australia in the world. And this case includes a gold washing cradle from our collection that allows us to tell the story of Hargraves, the man who's credited with the discovery of gold in near Ophir in 1851. And he'd been in California and at the gold rushes there, and he recognised similarities in the landscape between where he'd been living near Bathurst and where he was digging for gold in California. And he thought, maybe I should rush back and see if there's gold in them there hills too. So he rushed back, and he was right, there was gold there. And we've been able to borrow the letter that he wrote to the government identifying that he had found gold near Ophir. He doesn't say where he's found it. I have found gold at blank. And also the nugget that may be the compounded nugget that he used to prove that he had actually found the gold. So that's going to be quite special too. We've also got exhibits there relating to a Canadian gold miner who came to Australia, as well as material relating to the Chinese use of kiln technology in Bendigo. So the gold exhibit will be quite substantial. We also have exhibits relating to convict love tokens, which you may have heard the talk on those. So pennies that were left, engraved pennies left behind by convicts in Britain when they were transported to Australia. And we also have an exhibit about Macassan traders who came down from Indonesia and brought the equipment to gather sea cucumber in the north part of Australia, and eventually, having prepared that cucumber in gigantic cauldrons on the north coast, then sent it to China. Was anyone here for Alison's talk about the sea cucumber?
Yes.
Do you remember the smell?
Yes.
Yes? Well, you'll be able to enjoy it again, because that exhibit will have a smellorama where you can smell the sea cucumber. So perhaps don't schedule lunch either before or after that. I think that might be a bit gruesome. Then following around, there's some exhibits about Welsh music in Australia, and also one about Adelaide Ironside, who was the first native-born Australian artist to study art abroad. But then we get to an exhibit that looks at the invention of mechanical shearing in Australia in the 1870s, 80s and 90s. So two very large exhibits relating to the history of wool and how the wool industry has connected Australia to the world. Frederick Wolseley and his team's invention of mechanical shearing in the late 19th century revolutionised how wool could be harvested from sheep. For 4,000 years, people had used hand blades, but the particular environmental and economic conditions in Australia were able to spur Wolseley on to the invention and application of mechanical devices to shearing. And he was able to adapt some technologies from horse clippers and essentially revolutionise the shearing industry by inventing the shearing machine. So the exhibit will include an evolution. You'll be able to actually track the evolution of Wolseley's invention from the very earliest experimental pieces that he developed right through to the final patterns and designs. And we've, thanks to the generosity of a number of private lenders and the Walgett Historical Society, we'll be able to show a sequence of hand pieces that Wolseley was using to experiment with. So they contain all sorts of crazy ideas about how you might be able to improve the handpiece, but they are together a remarkable testament to Wolseley and his team's ingenuity and inventiveness in rural Australia in the late 19th century. There's also an exhibit next to it that deals with the pink woolen dress that comes from the Springfield collection. Many of you will have heard of the Springfield collection, a major acquisition for the museum in the last 2 years of colonial material associated with a very significant merino stud in the Goulburn area. And we are focusing this exhibit around an 1880s, it's even more pink than it looks on that slide, it's musk pink dress, which we think was worn by Lillian Faithful, one of the Faithful family daughters. But this exhibit really looks at how it was made by David Jones and Company. So the David Jones that we know, the firm began in the mid-19th century, and by the 1880s it had establishments in London as well as Sydney. And the company was buying large amounts of woolen cloth, often made from the very wool that you would expect to have been produced on a property like Springfield, was being harvested, sent to England, you know, prepared and spun at the woolen mills in of northern England, and then sent back to Australia by the clothing manufacturers like David Jones. So we sort of track that whole loop from beginning to end. And there's some wonderful loans from the David Jones archive that we've been able to use there. I think as visitors sort of re-enter the main circulation route through the gallery, they then encounter three cases along the left-hand side of the balustrade. The first is the Macassan case that I told you about. The second is a case that displays mementos of the travels of the Aboriginal boys who left the New Norcia monastic settlement in Western Australia and travelled to a monastery in Cava in Italy, where they trained to be monks in the 1850s. So the story of those little boys is told in a showcase there, thanks to another generous loan from the New Norcia settlement itself. And we also have an exhibit along the balustrade that looks at Charles Darwin's voyage to Australia in the 1830s, when he was travelling around the world on HMS Beagle. That loan material in that case is highly significant. The case focuses on Darwin's observations of a lion ant in the Blue Mountains. Does anyone know the lion ant? It's a creature that sits at the bottom of a... It makes a cone in the sand, and then it sits at the bottom of the cone and waits for something to fall in. And then it leaps up, grabs it, and sucks all the juice out of it. And Darwin, observing this, the behaviour of this insect, realised that it displayed very similar behaviours and very similar shape, form, characteristics as the lion ants that had been observed in Europe. And that moment was one of those moments on the Beagle voyage that helped to crystallise for him some of his ideas about evolution and how creatures that lived in different continents separated by vast amounts of ocean could somehow have grown to look and behave in a similar way. And that case includes a loan from the British Museum of the Beagle's chronometer, one of its many chronometers, and also insects that Darwin collected in Hobart and Sydney on that voyage from the Oxford Museum of Natural History. So that's a quite special. We've been very lucky and blessed to have been able to have lent that highly significant material, particularly in a year that... Well, the period from here on in really represents some quite significant anniversaries in terms of the publication of The Origin of the Species and of Darwin's own life. So it's going to be quite special. We then move through the period from Federation to World War II. And here you'll find exhibits relating to George Read, the Australian parliamentarian, who you may have heard me, I think, speak about last time. We also have a large case that focuses on World War I and there we are able to. Here's the Reed stuff if you missed it. George Reed's wig tin and walking stick, and exploring his journey to Britain in 1897 to obtain secret instructions relating to the development of the Australian Constitution. But we also have an exhibit relating to an Australian serviceman, Thomas Rutledge, who served overseas during World War I, and another exhibit that looks at the trousseau of an Australian woman who made her trousseau whilst waiting for her fiancé who had gone to the Great War. Sadly, he was killed in Belgium, and she packed away her trousseau forever. And so the exhibit looks at her experiences. We also have material, as some of you may already be familiar, relating to the 1929, 30, 31 Banzar Antarctic expedition led by Mawson. The museum holds the debris camera that Frank Hurley used to make the film Siege of the South, and the exhibit includes the camera, Mawson's proclamation claiming parts of the Antarctic continent, and also amazing scientific material gathered on the voyage, including, I think, would you say this is our favourite named object in the gallery? I think assorted sea gunk, it's called. It's stuff that was trawled up from the bottom of the ocean by the expedition and put in a jar, and we have the jar, and you can sort of see the little shrimps and strange creatures that were found under the sea. So then, at that point, if I just go back into the... going forward. So we're now here. At this point, visitors can choose to have a bit of a rest because they've already seen an awful lot of stuff here. So this triangular area here is a rest area. There you'll be able to sit down and maybe read a book, read some material associated with the exhibits in the gallery, learn a little bit more, but also watch and look at this rather amazing object, the Little Red Riding Hood wall hanging. Now, Karen, you have to correct me if I'm wrong. This is a wall hanging made in a displaced persons camp during just after World War II by a Ukrainian displaced person named Olga Basilevich, who made the wall hanging out of scraps of material that she could gather together by trading. What did she trade, Karen?
She traded cigarettes.
Cigarettes, and she was able to pull together the scraps of fur and felt and wool to make the hanging, and she applied those to a woolen blanket from the camp. And the quilt was eventually given to an Australian aid worker who was running the camp at that stage, Karen, Valerie Paling, and she brought it back to Australia and donated it to the Forest Hill Kindergarten, where it hung for about 40 years or so. Yeah. So this quilt is quite a remarkable testament to life in those displaced people's camps in Europe in that post-war period, and how intimately Australia's histories are connected to those camps, not only through the migrants who they brought to Australia, but also through the Australians who worked in them. You'll be able to see this quilt come to life, but I'm not going to tell you how yet. You'll have to come and see. I think as visitors re-enter the gallery, they'll then pass a couple of exhibits relating to World War II. A large screen shows Damien Parra's award-winning film Kokoda Frontline, and we also are able to display the camera, Parra's camera, which he used to film that, amongst other World War II documentary films. And we also have an exhibit that relates to an Australian war bride who married an American GI and moved to America and lived on Alcatraz. Jeez, it's tiring to talk about this guy. I wondered why. Yeah. There's a lot in it, isn't there? We're only halfway through. So then As we move back, turn the corner, back through the central axis, this is where the World War II material is. We're then walking towards the Visions Theatre down the final sort of axis of the gallery. There we will find exhibits relating to post-war migration to Australia. British migration is explored in relation to how settlers from Britain, 10-pound Poms and others, adapted to the Australian environment by growing British gardens in Australia. There's a case that deals with the story of Indonesian political prisoners who were displaced to Australia in World War II, and also further exhibits relating to displaced people, including the Mrs. Kinney dress, if you attended Karen's talk about the Kinney dress. But then we also get to a wonderful exhibit about Australians living abroad during the 50s, 60s and 70s, and we're very honoured that Rolf Harris has agreed to donate to us his second wobble board. The first one is still in his hands, but the second wobble board that he used throughout the 1960s, right up to the period of his rediscovery almost by the world when he covered Led Zeppelin's Stairway to Heaven. So this is the Stairway to Heaven wobble board, we call it. But we also have an exhibit that deals with the experiences of the Australian authors Charmian Clift and George Johnston, who lived in Greece during the 1950s. And that exhibit also explores the experiences of the Calymnian divers who came to Australia and worked in Darwin during the that same post-war period. There are another couple of exhibits following that explore the role of migrants in Australian agricultural industry. There's a collection of timber cutting equipment and make-do furniture that evokes the experience of British migrants in Denmark, Western Australia, so they were group settlers. And the second case explores the work of the Italian migrant Carmelo Mirabelli, another exhibit developed by Karen sitting up the back. Here's Carmelo. Karen, do you want to briefly talk about Carmelo? I'm being recorded, so I'll do it. But Carmelo travelled to Australia from Sicily in the immediate post-war period and spent 8 years travelling around, cutting cane, picking grapes, picking fruit through Victoria and Queensland. And Karen's put together a really strong and emotional collection of material related to his journey and his photography. So he took his camera with him everywhere, documented his life and the life of those people around him, and then sent those photos back to his mother in Sicily along with remittance money to keep his family at home. So it's a big collection, and it's a very poignant story, and an amazing kind of, it sort of really epitomises the kind of connections that we're trying to create in this gallery. The idea that a boy who learns to pick fruit in Sicily during World War II is then applying his special Sicilian fruit picking technique in Shepparton in the 1950s and 60s and teaching those Aussies a little bit about how you can become the fastest fruit picker in Shepparton by trying the Italian method of picking rather than the one that was already in Australia. So it's a great exhibit. Then there's an exhibit that deals with Australia's participation in the international scientific community, and it brings together specimens, lantern slides and a diary that were created by the Australian ornithologists Hall and Trebilco, who undertook a groundbreaking study of birds who migrate between Australia and Siberia. So the gallery is not just about the migrations of people, but it also includes the migrations of animals. So I'm not sure how many of you are aware that the sort of shorebirds of Australia migrate to Siberia to breed. And Hall and Trebilco were Australian ornithologists who travelled in 1903 to Siberia to collect the first specimens in Siberia. And we've been able to borrow those specimens, which are now in the American Museum of Natural History, and pair those up with material relating to the contemporary work of scientists who are continuing to explore those migratory bird paths and what they mean to the ecological health of the planet. So now visitors are approaching the Visions Theatre end of the gallery, and they'll find exhibits that relate to the more recent history of Australia's interconnections with the rest of the world. There's a very long case, which you can see there just near the bulkhead, which explores how the arts have sustained connections across the oceans. There's exhibits relating to Irish dancing, a Moroccan artist who works in Australia using techniques and designs from her homeland, and the musical practices of a Vietnamese migrant, Minh Tam Nguyen, whose bamboo musical instrument was extensively researched by Jen, who's sitting up the back there, and his story of the invention of the instrument in a Vietnamese prisoner of war camp during the Vietnam War, and then arrival in Australia as a refugee. So they're a group that really look at sort of cultural connections. And then if you were to turn left, you would find an exhibit about the Anglo-Australian Telescope and the development of that remarkable instrument in Coonabarabran, and the journey of Herman Wainer, who's sitting just there, who came to Australia in the 50s to work at Mount Stromlo. So we will be exploring the way in which the development of telescopes and Herman's work at Stromlo and on the Anglo-Australian Telescope brought Australia into the international, or connected Australia to that, made Australia an important part of what is a broad international astronomical community throughout the 1950s, 60s, 70s and 80s, and still today. And it's thanks to lenders like Herman that we're able to tell these stories. So I'm very glad that you're here today, Herman. We're now getting to the end of the gallery, and we will find an exhibit relating to Australia's participation in cricket over 120 or so years. Everything from W.G. Grace's bat, Victor Trumper's bat, the material relating to bodyline, to women's cricket in the 1930s, and then to contemporary players like Shane Warne and Steve Waugh, Greg Chappell and Rod Marsh. So a big exhibit about cricket, and another about the development of the Kuta Line surf brand, so the way in which Australia's surf culture is part of the international surfing scene. And then we will finally be struck by a large showcase that looks at the Arakoon sculptures, which were, I think I have a drawing, there's the cricket material. These are the sculptures that were produced in Arakoon during the 1960s, entered the museum's collection in the 1970s, and were then displayed in New York as part of the first major exhibit of Indigenous art overseas, the Dreamings exhibition in 1988. So that exhibit really looks at how Indigenous art was taken to the world in the late 1980s and has become such a significant way in which Australia is thought about internationally since then. So by then you will have been soaked in stories. You've had a really rushed tour of the gallery today. I think that when you get to see it in real life, you'll have much more time to look and read and wonder and reflect. And to me, it seems like the kind of gallery that you might want to come back to, like see something, read and learn and look, and then come back and look at something else the next time. I think it will reward multiple visits. So that's the walkthrough. I guess just to finish, I just want to give you a bit of a feel for when you will be able to make that walk. You will be able to walk through the gallery, hopefully as part of a friends event. I think you'll be the first members of the public to see this gallery, which is a great opportunity, and I hope you'll be able to take part when we hold those tours. But members of the public will be able to visit the gallery from the period just before Christmas. Between now and then, a lot of things have to happen. We've finished the primary works, which were the construction work, the recarpeting and repainting, and pop up and have a look, as I said, see what's happened. Over the next 3 weeks, the lighting track gets installed and the showcases are built on site. Conservation treatment on those 744 objects is almost complete. Almost all of the objects have been assessed for their mount, so each of those 744 objects has an individual mount, either a kind of flat mount or a wire mount that holds it in the particular position it's supposed to be in. And they're being built, and the objects are being packed, ready to come to the museum, ready for install at the beginning of November. We've got 6 weeks to install the 744 objects. And once we've closed the showcase doors, installed the graphics and the multimedia and adjusted the lighting, then we'll throw open the doors and you'll be able to come and see what we've done. So we'll look forward to seeing you, the friends, a very special group of people who've been journeying with us as we've been making Australian Journeys over the next couple of months, as we're able to show you the gallery in its next stages of life. But for now, I'd like to thank you for your patience and for listening, and to throw open the floor for any questions that you might have. Thank you. Here's my pointer. Has anyone got any questions? Anything you're curious about, you'd like to know more about? Oh, yes, up the back. Who was the first one? Excellent.
Start that all over again. Is this working?
Yep.
It's going to be absolutely wonderful. I'm wondering how much you've touched on the Asian Australian population, because, you know, the Chinese arrivals and journeys and influence and that sort of stuff, and the Japanese as well. I'm just wondering how much this nudist will touch on and explore that region area.
Yeah, no, it's an important part of Australia's interconnections with the world, and particularly those migration stories. So the main ones that I've highlighted today are the, if you think about sort of Asia and the Pacific as being an area, we've tried to explore the Macassans, so the Indonesian contact over many centuries associated with the Trepang trade, and that exhibit opens out to explore the contact with the whole of Southeast Asia and China through that trading network. The European Voyaging exhibit contains a lot of material associated with the European contact with Asia that ultimately brought Europeans to the West Coast as they're trying to sail up to trade porcelain and tea and spices. They run into the coast of Western Australia. Perhaps more specifically, we have exhibits relating to the a Chinese brick kiln that was used in Bendigo in the 1850s and 60s, where a group of former Chinese miners grouped together to make bricks to build the local town. We've got material associated with the Indonesian Dutch prisoners who were sent to the Kaura POW camp in World War II. And then we explore the Vietnamese migration experience through the story of the bamboo musical instrument. We have been developing a series of other stories associated with Asian migration and connections that will appear in subsequent versions of the gallery, if you like. A permanent gallery is never complete. So the minute we open the gallery in December, we will be planning for the first changes that will happen. And those exhibits, there are a number of exhibits that we have almost queued up that will further explore those Asian connections with Australia. So it's something we're extremely conscious of the significance of. Yeah. Did I miss anything? Kuta Lines, which also deals with Indonesian and Chinese textiles, or sort of the whole ikat tradition in Asia, that the Kuta Lines surf brand picked up this particular weaving and dyeing technique and made it into a global surf brand. So, yeah.
Well, thank you once again for your animated talk. Your enthusiasm always comes right through. You said we're going to have a smell-a-thon.
Yes.
Are you going to have audio-visual things that click on as you go past and that kind of thing?
Absolutely. Right. There's a number of multimedia components to the gallery. There are a series of what you'd probably call interactives. So if you imagine walking up to a screen, and particularly in front of the European Voyaging exhibit and the cricket exhibit, you'll be able to find out, be able to delve into a number of layers of information about every object in the case. For example, we've got a chronometer in the showcase for the European Voyaging exhibit, and we've been able to get the conservators to get it started, and we filmed it, and you'll be able to watch the chronometer being wound and turning over and see the insides, and you'll be able to watch a film about how the Florilegium was printed, and be able to watch clips of great moments in Australian cricket, or not so great moments. So there's a series of sort of touchscreen interactives. There's also a number of audiovisual pieces. So you'll be able to watch segments from Frank Hurley's film Siege of the South. You'll be able to watch migratory birds in flight as they voyage from Australia to Siberia. What else, Karen and Jen? Anyone else is here? Rolf Harris. You'll be able to watch some of Rolf's greatest performances. You'll be able to listen to the sound of the gamelan that we've borrowed. Oh, yes, there's a... Does anyone know the Expo 67 sound chairs? They're like an individual personalised armchair with speakers in the headset part. And you'll be able to sit in there and listen to different songs from Wales and Scotland and Britain that were sung in Australia or sung in Britain to connect people who were imagining their loved ones in another country. So like a lot of Welsh tunes like My Little Welsh Home and sea shanties and songs that kind of were a source of solace to migrants who moved to Australia and helped connect them to their homeland. So there's some other... there's an interactive so you can watch different instruments associated with the invention of the Dan tray. And have I missed anything important, Karen? There's many, many of them. The answer's yes. Sorry, Karen, did I?
And also the use of the visual theatre.
Absolutely right, yep. Yeah, so we're hoping that because of the proximity of visions to the gallery, we'll be able to show some films at full length. So we can't show all of Siege of the South because it's an hour plus long, but we can probably schedule times of the day where you could go and see the whole of the film. So we've used multimedia quite actively.
Is there anything on the outback and the cattle industry, such as the Juraks who moved from Goulburn to southwest Queensland and then over to Kimberley?
Yep. In this gallery, no. But in the gallery that is being developed downstairs for the new, you know the Nation area? You know where the Nation Gallery is now? That whole area is the next gallery that we're developing, and it actually has an exhibit about the Juraks. Not in this gallery, but in the next one.
What is that gallery called?
It's currently called Nation, but in 2 years' time it will be called Creating a Country. Yeah. So it has a number of exhibits about the cattle and sheep, the pastoral industry. Yeah. But there is one about the Juraks. Yeah. That's right, isn't it, Jen? That's my understanding. Yeah.
I presume that second gallery will look at the the cultural development of the country.
Yep.
I'm conscious that there's an exhibition on the Irish in Australia coming up in 2 or 3 years' time,
yep,
which will have some focus on the Catholic versus the Protestants, mm-hmm, etc.
Mm-hmm.
But because the sort of religious overlays and the intellectual overlays, yep, of Australia are quite significant.
Yeah. I think that's a really, really good point. And the new gallery will explore those themes. It's a very large and expansive gallery which will explore the major themes in Australian history, and those ones that you've identified are incorporated into that gallery.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.